Hey everybody, welcome to Creature Feature, the show where we crack open the heads of animals and humans and get on that brain train with a one-way ticket to explore the wildest behaviors in the human and animal kingdom. Toot toot! I'm your host of many parasites, Katie Golden. I studied psychology and evolutionary biology, and I ate ants as a kid because I thought ant eaters were cool. Don't do ants, kids. Today we're going to bust some... Sorry, I almost infringed on some copyright there. We're going to, get out my thesaurus. We're gonna wallop some legend, explode some old wives' tales. We're gonna disable some fables and contusion some illusions. So, throughout history, there have been some pretty ridiculous animal myths. In 18th century Sweden, folklore had it that witches turned themselves into wild hares who would suck the milk dry from cows. In medieval Europe, authors of bestiaries thought weasels conceived through their mouths and gave birth through their ears. And Europeans used to think that maggots were spontaneously generated by meat or food that had been left out, until in 1668, when Francesco Redi had the brilliant idea of testing rotting meat in jars, covering some and leaving some open, and found that, interestingly, the jars left open where flies landed would start to generate maggots. He then observed the maggots developing into flies and put two and two together. These old myths may seem silly, but evolutionary biology is a continually evolving field, and science has always been open to new and contrasting information. So we're going to look at some popular myths today, burst them wide open, and talk about the truths that are even more fascinating than the myths. Joining me today is co-host of Nerdificent, comedian, TV writer, and Goku apologist, Iffy Wadaway.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. I think it's great that they used to think weasels conceived through their mouths and gave birth through their ears. Because that's like something like a five-year-old me would have probably thought. Like, you get pregnant by kissing and then like the baby comes out of your ears.
Oh yeah, I'm sure there's some like, you know, Japanese like anime art of birth being given through the mouth.
Oh yeah, you know? I'm sure if you Google that, turn that safe search on, although I'm not sure that's going to help you.
I totally remember the maggot thing because I remember that diagram. It stood out to me in my biology book in elementary school of like, why is there meat in the jar? Oh, there's maggots there.
Right.
And then I was like, oh, this is a cool experiment.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny to me because it's like, you see the logic of you see meat and then you see maggots like, well, they just came right out of the meat.
Yeah, because flies, they're real sneaky. They get in there and they get out.
Yeah, they don't look like maggots. Yeah. So why would you think they're the same thing?
Yeah.
All right. So first I want to talk about Komodo dragons.
I'm already interested.
And there's a big myth about them that I think but when you look at like the actual truth, it's a lot cooler. So just to catch everyone up, Komodo dragons are big, giant, enormous, scary lizards. They're native to the Indonesian islands. They grow up to be a maximum of 10 feet long and 150 pounds, which is like the size of like a, you know, huge person.
Yeah. That's like 3 fax machines.
Right. I do like that unit. That really gives you, because if you've ever tried to lift a fax machine.
Oh, yeah.
They're carnivorous predators who hunt and kill their prey. And their main diet is, well, they'll pretty much eat anything they can get their teeth on, but it's deer and carrion. Oh. So dead things and deer. And sometimes they'll eat their own young, you know.
You know, as they do.
As you do in nature sometimes. I mean, a lot of animals do that, so they're not they're not weird for doing that.
Do you remember that video that went viral of the crab mother eating all the baby crabs? Oh. And it's just, I didn't expect to be as unnerved by it.
Well, you know, in the Christmas Island, crabs are so numerous that the adults will just, like, eat a bunch of the kids, and it's fine because there's, like, millions of them, so, you know. They also, Komodo dragons are pretty aggressive, so they do attack humans, and I think they've actually killed some people. I wouldn't call them dangerous because it's not like you'll encounter one, but if you do encounter one, it could. Remember did you see, what was it, Skyfall?
The James Craig, Bond one? Yeah.
The Craigie one?
Yeah.
They had like a scene where I think they tried to assassinate him with a Komodo dragon.
I love when movies employ animals to assassinate people, right, because it's like, you're not Aquaman.
Right, then, right.
Like, I'm going to put a snake in his room, yeah, and then it'll bite him.
It's like, get him, Francis.
Yeah.
And it's like, just hanging out.
Yeah.
Snake in one corner, just like, just chilling out there. Yeah, so the myth about Komodo dragons that you may have heard of is that they kill because their saliva is so full of bacteria that it, like, puts their prey into septic shock. So, like, they bite their prey. Their saliva is so nasty and full, yeah, of dangerous bacteria that it literally, it, like, infects the wound. And then they slowly stalk their prey and then wait for it to die. And they can wait for many days for their prey to finally succumb to their wound. And that's certainly the story that I've heard, and I used to believe. This is not true.
Oh.
At all. So here's the fact. Komodo dragons are venomous because of all the venom in their venom glands. Not because their spit is gross.
That's so funny, because that was gonna be my guess of what, yeah, the myth was, is that they're venomous.
Right.
I was going to say poisonous, but that's wrong.
Well, poison is ingested. Venom is contact or injected. Yeah.
Got it.
They have these serrated razor sharp teeth that are just like a bunch of knives with, the kind of that serrated barb. So really great, yeah, at shredding things up. And those rip open a wound. And then the venom found in glands in their lower jaw will cause shock in the animal by decreasing their blood pressure. It works as an anticoagulant, which makes them bleed faster. And so they will typically die within 30 minutes.
Oh. So they don't even need to stalk.
No. I mean, they stalk before the prey is dead. So, you know, to like a... You know, you can imagine a lioness kind of stalking prey and then killing it. It's a similar thing, except it's a horrible lizard. And they actually have one of the most complex venom duct systems in reptiles. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make it better. It's very inefficient, but they have these venom ducts between their teeth. And so when they bite down, it kind of irrigates into the wound. And so they kind of, as they pull and shred, that like gooshes the venom into the wound.
Like kind of like a syringe in a sense.
Yeah, it's like its mouth is full of syringes. And they actually, in terms of their saliva being nasty, that bacteria is similar to other carnivores. So even though they do have certain bacteria cultures in their saliva, when they measure other carnivores, it's basically the same. So it's not unique to them. They also practice pretty good oral hygiene. They've brushed their teeth with leaves. So like after they've, you know, maybe made a snack of some dead deer, they will like mush their face into leaves and brush their teeth. And then they lick their lips for like 10 to 15 minutes cleaning themselves. And so there's no rotting chunks of flesh hanging from their mouths. They're actually pretty fastidious.
Ooh.
Like 15 minutes, that's better than me.
Yeah, that's a very long time to clean your teeth. That's what you know.
And yeah, so they don't slowly stalk their prey over days. It usually takes about 30 minutes.
Okay.
There's probably outliers, and maybe that's what people have observed, where maybe some prey got away and survived a lot longer than it typically does. And then the assumption being, oh, it must do this intentionally. But when all things go to plan, it's in and out.
Yeah.
In and out Komodo burger.
So if I were to fight a Komodo dragon, okay, I should stay away from the teeth is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think that's generally the good strategy. So, I want to say you probably shouldn't fight a Komodo dragon. Okay. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it.
I mean, how speedy are they?
They can be pretty fast.
Okay,
yeah.
I feel like, you know, I'm pushing 228 if I just get on top and hold the, you know, they got that lizard motion. So you just get down on them. I'm on the back.
I mean, you know, I think if you really wanted to fight one, which again, Don't do it.
Okay.
Not advocating for that. Lawyers, get off our backs. We're not saying you should fight a Komodo dragon.
This is iffy specific. I'm the only one qualified to fight
exactly,
animals.
Right, exactly. So nobody else try this out.
No one else.
But you, if you were fighting it, I would definitely like try to grab its tail.
Ooh.
Sort of the crocodile hunter-esque thing where you grab its tail so that you can always be behind it. Because you don't want it, and it's going to try to whip around to bite you.
Yeah. That's basically its superpower.
Right, exactly. So if you can get that tail and then just kind of like keep twirling it around, like you're dancing, like a dance partner.
Yeah.
Then maybe, you know, you could.
Until it gets tired.
Until it's tired. And or it falls in love with you.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, you can really dance.
I know. We're
dancing. All right, so the next animal myth I want to cover, and this is a really popular one, is that wolves have an alpha and beta pack structure.
Oh, wait, what?
So the idea is that you have a group of adult wolves, and they get together, and the alpha males will fight for dominance. So you have this wolf that's just wolfier than all the other wolves.
Mm-hmm.
It fights and bites its way to the top, and then it's elected leader of the wolves just by merit of being the most aggressive. And maybe there's also an alpha female that does the same thing. She like, you know, bullies all the other females, comes to work with a bunch of flowers and is like, hey, yeah, my husband got me these. Oh, what, you didn't get any flowers? Oh, I'm sorry. So, you know, alpha. And so, but this is not true. The way this came about was in the 1940s, this researcher, Rudolf Schenk, documented wolf behavior, and he observed wolves fighting for dominance. But the problem was he was studying captive wolves, so wolves in a zoo. And captive animals often behave differently than wild animals due to their different environment, and they will be in conflict more often because they don't have as much space. So in the wild, when you have fights between animals, one of the animals will often have an area to retreat and cool off and kind of give the aggressor some space, and then they kind of work it out that way. So it's like, you know, if you're in an argument with someone, they storm off. But if you're in a tiny room with someone and you argue, there's nowhere for you to go. So the argument is just going to keep going and going. And so that doesn't necessarily happen in the wild. And in fact, now what's thought is that wolf packs are just basically family units. So a mom and a dad and children.
Oh, wow.
And so the parents may use intimidation at times, and it's not as if they don't do dominance displays, but these are more within the family structure. So they didn't become the alpha male and female because they fought their way to the top. They're the alpha male and female because they're the mom and the dad.
Yeah.
And so there was a wild biologist, L. David Mick. He used to write about the alpha wolf structure, and like he used to subscribe to that belief. But as he continued to observe wolves in the wild, he realized he was wrong. And he was like, okay, actually, these look like these are just families. And yeah, they like fight it out, and there's dominance and submissive behaviors, but that's within the family structure. And one source I read said that like the older the individual, the more likely they are to be dominant, which makes sense
because,
you know, older brothers.
And that's when I started fighting with my dad. I was like, hey, Dad, I don't like these rules. Split off, you get your own pack. He's like, if you do not like these, then go and start your own pack. If you do not want to be in my pack. Yeah, this one hits pretty hard for me because there was this game when I was in high school called Furcadia.
Mm.
It was a furry game, but there were different worlds in it.
I see.
And you would go, and I was real into wolves. I liked ever since American Werewolf in Paris,
right.
I was like, I was a wolf guy.
Right.
And so we would, so we went to the wolf world, and then me and the girl I had a crush on at the time, we had a pack.
I see.
So I was the alpha wolf.
We
were spreading misinformation among the Furcadia
Among
community.
Many crimes committed by the Furcadia community.
Yeah. One of them being spreading wolf information.
Right.
And I apologize to wolves.
Well, apology accepted on behalf of wolves.
Yeah.
I speak for the wolves. I think one of the effects that this has had has been on dog training, because dogs descended from wolves, that's true, and their behavior is similar to wolves in a lot of ways. Obviously, they're very different because of the, you know, thousands of years of domestication. But that idea of the alpha pack structure, I think, has informed dog training. And because it's not necessarily true in wolf populations, that means that a lot of the information we have about dog training might not be correct. Yeah. So dog training is going under a constant evolution of trying to figure out, you know, hey, maybe there's different ways to communicate with your dog, and sort of potentially like dominating your dog might not be the answer. I'm certainly not a qualified dog trainer, so I don't want to say like, oh no, there's only a certain way to train your dog, because I don't know. But I think it is something that we have to continually examine as we get in new information. My dog and I, I've found that there's no way to really dominate my dog. She's tiny, she's like 13 pounds, but her personality is not, she cannot be dominated. There's no, you know, there's no way I'm going to do that. It's always a negotiation with her, a sort of tepid negotiation.
Well, see, that's why you got to try the family structure thing.
Right, exactly.
You know, sit backwards in a chair and say, hey, let's wrap.
Hey, buddy, listen. Yeah.
What's going on?
Listen, buddy. I feel like we don't talk anymore.
Yeah.
She's licking her crotch.
Yeah. It's like, when I was your age, you know, I felt the same way.
Right. I mean, granted, when I was your age, I was, you know, not licking my own crotch, but, you know, it's all right. It's all right. We all grow at our own pace.
Sucking on a pacifier, licking your own crotch.
Listen,
potato.
Exactly. All right. So one last animal myth here. So bulls are those fearsome male cows. And of course, I'm going to stay off top, like bullfighting, not a big fan of it.
Yeah. It's kind of trash.
Yeah. I mean, like, I understand the cultural history of it, and I respect that, but, you know, I like the more modern bullfighting where you don't actually hurt the bull.
Yeah, we can upgrade. You know,
yeah, we
you
could.
Know.
I mean,
we can make a WWE for bulls now.
I mean, like, I'm still kind of like, I don't necessarily think it's good to even just harass a bull. Like, that, to me, it's also dangerous, and I just don't know. But I feel like if we could have like an updated bullfight where it's like a robot bull, I'd be super into that.
It's a mech bull.
Yeah, a mecha bull. Yeah. Could you imagine?
Oh, that'd be way cooler.
And the challenge would, because this would be a bull with like a computer's intelligence.
I know. So you still keep the machismo there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Everyone's happy.
Right. I mean, you'd need a gun, obviously, but.
I was thinking you get like a laser sword.
I think a laser sword is good. That's showy.
So I'm
sure a lot of people think that bulls are angered by the color red, because that's, you know, part of, I mean, that's a fact that we're taught from a very young age by Looney Tunes cartoons. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, that's not true, as you might have guessed from the structure of this podcast. But bulls can't even differentiate between the red and green. Like, they're red-green colorblind, so like they can't see in that, within that color spectrum. That doesn't mean they can't see colors. It's just like red and greens are going to sort of be the same.
Yeah, see, I thought color. I knew, because Maya was like, because they're colorblind, but I didn't know they're only red, green color.
Yeah, so. I mean, it's, but you know, the basic principle is the same, where they can't really distinguish red, and they're not, there's no evidence that they're angered by that color.
Yeah, they're angered because they're put in a ring.
Yes.
And someone's waving a cloth at them.
Exactly. So it's the antagonizing motions of the bullfighter that, you know, is maybe frustrating for them. You know, it's kind of a funny thing to me, where it's like you have this guy waving things around and like it's poking him with sharp sticks, and it's like, he's mad at the color.
Yeah,
I think
that red is making him real mad.
Doesn't care for red. I guess he's more of a winter.
Yeah. It's really in the pastels.
But here's a cool fact. Bees actually are the ones who are angered by the color red.
Wait,
so
really?
Bees are the ones.
Oh, that seems like something that people should know.
Yes. So if you don't want to anger bees, don't wave red at them.
Is there a reason?
Yes. So to bees, red actually appears black, like a dark color. And black and dark colors are the colors of predators that they are on high alert for, like bears and honey badgers, these pesky, like Pooh Bear type animals.
Yeah.
Wait a second. Pooh Bear wears red.
Ooh.
It goes all the way to the top. And so they're often under attack by these hungry bears going like, I want some honey. So when they see those dark colors, they're like, oh, this is a bear trying to get our precious honey. And then they go out on the attack. So if you don't want to get attacked by bees, you shouldn't wear red.
Mm. Yeah. But you should carry red paint if, you know, you're ever going to encounter a bear, distract them by covering them in paint. The bees will get them and you're safe.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine how cute that would be. You just like paint on a little red shirt. It's like, oh, look, you're Winnie the Pooh. And then it just like, rips you apart. Oh, yeah. But your last few moments will be cute.
Oh, yeah. Well, you got to get the speed. You got to get the low. You can see the thing. The scary thing about bears, you know, is that there's conflicting rules for different bears. Like, where, like, I think it's the grizzly. Is the grizzly the one that you're supposed to be, make yourself bigger? Like, one, you're supposed to make yourself bigger, and one, you're supposed to play dead. And that's...
Yeah, I think... I'm pretty sure... Okay, don't take my word for it. I definitely want you guys to double-check this before you go out and antagonize any bears, which you shouldn't do.
Yeah, but unless you're me.
Yeah, okay, so if he is the only person who can fight bears and Komodo dragons.
And gorillas.
And... All right. Yeah.
Strength is strength. Look, see, we can have this conversation right now. I've just, you know, made strength is strength. If a gorilla's arms were weighed down so that they had the strength of a human.
Okay. Well, couldn't they just use those weights, though?
That's what everyone's saying, but I'm like, then it's not heavy enough. If they're using them weights and it's making them hit me harder, the weights aren't heavy enough. They need the strength of a human.
If you put like really, like if you put like, really slippery shoes or like roller skates on a gorilla so its center of mass is like out of balance. Like you put roller skates on all you put roller skates on its hands and its feet, then I think maybe you could beat it. Otherwise I'm not sure.
Yeah, the origin of this dumb bit of me fighting a gorilla came from when I was writing on At Midnight, that video of the two gorillas fighting that went viral. Mm-hmm. And I've never, like, all the gorilla videos I've seen have been very docile. And for some reason, my only reaction in seeing that gorilla charge across the the enclosure and attack that gorilla was, well, I guess I can't fight a gorilla. And everyone stopped and goes, wait, Iffy, up until this point, did you think you could fight a gorilla? I doubled down and I was like, you know, I feel like under the right circumstances.
Yeah. I can understand that because, I mean, you're seeing me. You can tell I'm not necessarily a fighter.
Yeah.
But when I think about, like, say, a mountain lion attacking, I'm like, I could kick a mountain lion away. I think I could do it. But, you know, you don't really grasp that the pure muscle.
Yeah.
Like a mountain lion, it's not like partially like, you know, sort of fatty tissue where it's just like, oh, you know, like a pudgy little kitty where, you know, you can fight a cat. But a mountain lion is just coiled muscles. Yeah. Just
ready to pounce. Like they're built to pounce. It's so funny because it's that conversation always comes up on why men live shorter lives than women. And I feel like there's this inherent idiocy in men where we're like, yeah, I think I can.
You look at a Komodo dragon, you hear about its like mini venom glands and its sharp teeth, and then you think, but couldn't I? Maybe.
I'm sure it has something that goes deep down into our evolution of the peacocking of trying to look like the strongest hunter in the tribe, where it's like, I can do that.
I can do it.
Yeah, I'm going to
go. Pull me back, bro.
I'm going to punch that raptor in the face.
Like loincloths off, bro.
Yeah. But yeah, it's funny. These animals are terrifying at all times.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's the message I want to get out. We should love animals, but be scared of them.
Yeah, always.
Love and fear them. Sometimes animal myths aren't just silly, but can actually be dangerous. Take, for instance, peeing on a jellyfish sting. This myth holds that urine somehow deactivates jellyfish venom. In fact, the opposite may be true. When a jellyfish stings you, it rubs stinging cells onto your skin. These cells contain nematocytes, evil microscopic balloons filled with venomous barbs that inject venom. Rubbing the sting will make it worse, as that causes more nematocysts to activate. But urinating on the the sting, or even running fresh water over it will cause a sodium differential between the inside and outside of the nematocyst, again causing them to sting. The solution? Pour salt water over the sting, which will help wash it away without necessarily provoking the nematocysts. Unless your pee is really, really salty, urinating on your sting will just make it hurt more and cover you in pee. Good job, pee-pee leg! When we return, we'll explore some more human medical myths and find out that there are some incredible animals that are more amazing than the myths themselves. Throughout human history, we have attempted to quantify medicine, and well, we've often failed. We used to think that our eyes worked by shooting beams out of them until 1011, when Arab mathematician Hasan al-Hazan conducted experiments on the human eye and concluded that instead of emitting rays, the eyes received light that bounced off of objects, thus forming an image. Though you may not have heard of him, he's one of the first ever implementers of the scientific method. 5 centuries before Renaissance scientists figured it out. There are still, to this day, plenty of misconceptions about the human mind and body, but the thing is, sometimes the truth is even weirder than fiction, as me and my guest are about to discover. Ooh. Don't you think it's crazy that, like, we don't know about Hasan al-Hazan? Like,
yeah, it's real wild.
Like, I feel like, I mean, it's probably part of the reason is our education is pretty Eurocentric, like pretty Western-centric. Like, you know, Europeans, we've discovered science. That's not true. Yeah. But yeah, it's like he was one of the, in like 1011. Like, yeah. We hadn't even gotten into the teens yet. and he discovered how the eye functions and he used the scientific method.
Wow.
It's pretty incredible. And this kind of ties into the first thing I want to cover, which is this fact that is often spread around that we only use 10% of our brains.
Oh.
Have you ever heard that?
Oh, yeah. There's so many premises. As a nerd, there's so many premises that are based on
like that ScarJo movie.
Yeah. Well, you took the Limitless.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. ScarJo, she only uses 10% of her brain. Yeah, am I right?
Oh, zingaroni.
Bam, roasted. But like in that movie, I think it's like she gets a drug that lets her use 100% of her brain and then she becomes psychic. Is that right?
Yes, that's always what it is for some reason.
Right. It's like as if somehow if we used all of our brain, we could somehow receive brain signals from other people.
Was it Lucy?
Lucy, that's right, okay. Yeah, I remember that. Mm-hmm. That drove me a little crazy, like, those ads.
Yeah. And what is the, like, because, like, you know more about biology than the typical person. What are some, like, ads or premises that have made you roll your eyes?
I mean, that's a big one, the 10% of the brain being repeated ad nauseum. I think there's a lot of also just pop psychology where it's like, oh, women like this because of this reason or men this because of that reason. And it's like, well, I mean, you know, like, oh, men like trucks because of something way back in our evolution. It's like, I don't know if that tracks because like there weren't trucks back then.
Yeah.
So you can't necessarily abstract that to that level or like. It's in our DNA is used pretty commonly. It's like, is it really?
Yeah.
I don't know if it is. You have to prove it.
Yeah.
but with the 10% of our brains thing is, what is true is that at a given moment, maybe we are only using like 10% of our brain in terms of it might only be firing. But that's not like throughout the whole day. We'll be using all of our brain to varying degrees depending on the task that we're doing. Because imagine the alternative if like 100% of our brain was firing all at once. That would basically be like some kind of crazy psychotic experience where your brain explodes.
Yeah, if I nerd it up a bit, the CPU is your brain of the computer. And you put that under 100% load, you're going to fry that bad boy.
Exactly.
And you'll need to spend another large sum
like
of money.
Every experience, emotion, and thought you could ever possibly have, like firing at once, that doesn't even make sense because your brain doesn't really work just by thing. It's not like you have certain information stored in your brain that you just like turn on and turn off. It's patterns of activation. So your neurons forming a pattern where it's kind of a domino effect. One neuron fires and then like this domino effect of all these neurons firing in a pattern. And that it's that actual pattern of activation that is the thought or the memory or whatever. Everything firing at once. I don't even know if that would be a conscious experience. Yeah. I'm not sure what that would be. But we use all of our brain. It's not like there's a part of our brain that just, you know, crickets, cobwebs, doesn't get used. According to Scientific American, this fact may have come from historical psychologist William James, who wrote, quote, "We are making use of only a small part of our possible mental and physical resources," which I don't think that's, I'm not sure that's true, buddy.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe for some of us, like in general, like when you think of a person's potential, but the it's not like the human body has a hugely untapped brain power that if only you took the right supplement, you could get to. The muscles, it is true that there is more we can exert. Like we hear about times where people's adrenaline goes and like you can be triggered into your body working much more than it usually does, like being able to lift something heavier than you usually can. That's true to some extent, but it's not like, oh, if we could only tap into 100% of our body, we would become like the Hulk, except when he's smart, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So not true that we use 10% of our brain. Oh. But here's a fact that to me is crazier, and it's completely true. It's called unihemispheric slow wave sleep. And that means you can turn off half of your brain. One half of your brain is asleep and the other half is awake.
Whoa.
When I say you, I don't mean you, because this is only something animals can do. Certain species of dolphins, whales, seals, sea lions, manatees, and birds exhibit unihemispheric slow wave sleep. So it's literally one eye closed, one eye open, one half of the brain off and the other half of the brain on, essentially. I mean, one half is asleep. It's not off. It's like asleep.
Yeah.
And with our eyes and our brain, the hemispheres are actually kind of mixed up. So like mm-hmm. your right eye or your right field of vision is connected to your left side of your brain and vice versa. So when the right eye is closed, the left side of the brain is asleep in these animals. Why would they? First of all, I mean, it is kind of intuitive why you'd want to do that. Mm-hmm. And when I heard about it in school, I was like, this was in college, and I was like, huh. And so I would like close one eye during lectures because I was so sleep deprived.
Yeah, I wonder if you can like close one eye, like your left eye, to sleep with your right eye and then be really smart with your left brain.
Yeah, you know, it didn't work for me. So for sea mammals, the reason for this is pretty important. It allows them to continue sleeping while still surfacing for air because they have to breathe. They may look like fish, but they're not fish. So they got to still breathe. And so sleeping can present a problem for them when they need to continually breathe. And so that half sleeping allows them to surface and also to continue swim patterns and migration patterns while still kind of half sleeping. Same thing for birds. So they can half sleep during long migrations and still detect predators. So actually, birds can completely fall asleep while migrating, which blows my mind. So they can go into slow wave sleep while migrating over long distances and still navigate somehow.
That'll be us soon, you know, with our Teslas that are driving us, you know, we'll be migrating and we'll go to sleep. Even though they say not to do it.
Right.
Elon said, don't do it, y'all.
Don't do it. I mean, I don't think the cars are there yet, right? Yeah. They're not like fully automated. So you have to be at the wheel. I think there was a story about some guy who was like drunk in a Tesla and like the Tesla just like parked him on the Golden Gate Bridge or something. And like the cops came up and he was like dead asleep and is like, it's self-driving. It's like, and I think the car that he had didn't even have the full self-driving feature.
Yeah, it's still a work in progress. Yeah. They do over-the-air updates. But yeah, there's been some, like, sometimes it'll malfunction.
Right,
you know? But
I'm waiting for those like Honda mech legs that walk you places. And then you could be asleep. Did you ever watch Wallace and Gromit?
Very little.
There was one where it's like he's got these mechanized trousers because it's British, and then he's asleep and his upper torso is just flopping around while his like mecha pants are walking him around. Yeah.
That's the dream,
right? And so what's really cool about the birds who do the half asleep thing is that it's the birds, typically the birds on the edges of the flock, who are sort of have to be aware, and birds will like switch positions and stuff, and it's this kind of interesting communal situation. And so if they're on the outer edge, half of their brain will go asleep and one of their eyes will close, but the eye that's facing outward will be open and alert to predators. So say they're on like the right side, their right eye will be open, left hemisphere, which connects to the right eye, will be asleep, so they can stay alert to predators while they're flying and they're on that outside.
Yeah.
And so that's really cool. And the way that their brains can do this is acetylcholine, which is a neurotransmitter that can regulate brain activity and wakefulness, is withheld from their sleep portion of the brain while still being present in the awake half. So it's like this neurotransmitter being selectively released in different hemispheres of the brain.
That's awesome.
It's really cool. The many superpowers you could get if you were an animal, this is the one I wish the most.
You can just half sleep.
I tried so hard. I really wanted it to be true. Like I would close one eye and then it's like, am I resting? I can't tell. My teeth hurt. Is that normal? I was so sleep deprived in college. All right. So here's another biology interesting thing, which also reminds me of college, is the thing of like, oh, women synchronize their periods when they're roommates or they're friends and they live together. Have you heard this one?
Oh, yeah. I've heard this one.
Yeah. I've heard it, too. It's an oft-repeated thing of being a fact, and it's not. This is based on, I think, a 1971 study where researchers looked at a group of female college students, and the sample size was pretty small, and it was only over like 8 weeks, and they're like, these chicks synchronize their periods. Would you get a load of these dames?
Wow, yep, that sounds about right.
Actually, this is the 70s, so what would they be? These mamas?
yeah, these jive mamas over here with their periods all synced up. Oh, man, let me write this down in the medical journal, baby.
They're somehow making their hoo-haws work together. Yeah, so that's not, no study has been able to replicate that. And researchers today point out the many methodological problems and small sample size of the original studies. So it's really probably not true. Yeah. So it's technically unconfirmed. Obviously, it hasn't been proven to be negative necessarily, but there's no evidence that it's necessarily true. And I think most likely if you feel like it's true anecdotally, it could be that, like, you know, periods aren't, it's not like every 28 days on the dot, like they kind of like shift around. So you're going to have that occasional, you know, synchronization. It's like, oh my God, our periods are like the same. We're like twins.
We did it.
We're blood sisters.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard that blood sisters, blood moon sisters.
I mean, which is, that would be metal. I'd love to just be able to become blood sisters.
Yeah, yeah.
But unfortunately, it has to be the old-fashioned way where you do a human sacrifice. Anyways, there is an animal who does do this.
Really?
Lionesses do synchronize their periods. They are blood sisters in more ways than one. They are... they like to eat things.
Oh,
and kill things.
But see, that's a, you know, that's a deleted scene from The Lion King that we saw, which is
Nala and Sarabi are like, are you in estrus? No, me too. Weird coincidence.
Wow, this is cool.
Yeah, there's a lot we've talked about on the podcast how inaccurate The Lion King is. Man, there would be so much more killing in that.
Oh, really?
A lot of killing. I mean, there'd be no way. So when Scar takes over the pride, like he would kill all the cubs. So there's, you know, it's just, and also it doesn't make sense that it just doesn't make sense.
So you're saying they wouldn't be enemies with hyenas then?
Well, I mean, they would be, actually. That part is true because hyenas and lions are natural enemies because they are in the same sort of niche in terms of their prey. So hyenas will hunt. They're not just scavengers. And, and lions and hyenas will both try to steal each other's prey. So it's not just like a parasitic relationship between hyenas and lions. And lions will eat hyena cubs and hyenas will eat lion cubs. Typically, lions are the bigger jerks because they're just literally bigger.
Yeah.
But, you know, you get enough hyenas, you can overpower a lion. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
That's what happened at the end of Lion King. They showed
exactly,
us that.
Exactly. That part true. And actually, hyenas, like we've talked about before, they're a matriarchy and they have pseudo penises. They're really cool animals.
Oh,
yeah.
That's dope.
But lionesses will synchronize their estrus. So most animals other than humans and some primates don't really have periods in the way that human women do. I sounded so weird, like such a weird nerd. Human women. Show me your human women.
Yeah, please.
The human female.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, I love human women. Why would you think that I'm from outer space?
That Tinder profile, it's like you don't, it's like a trench coat all the way up to their eyeballs and the hands. Like I enjoy human women.
And their human body and needs.
I like their chest meats.
Oh, man.
So by going into estrus at the same time, this allows them safety in numbers for their cubs. So their cubs all happen at the same time. So statistically speaking, some of them should survive.
Yeah.
So like if a predator tries to pick off some of the cubs and you have this big group of cubs, like the likelihood that your cub is going to get eaten, not as much.
Yeah.
Which is a really touching thing. Yeah. The nicer thing is they do it also so they can communally raise the cubs so they can babysit and like they're all sort of in the same maternal mood and taking care of each other's cubs. And that's nice. What's not so nice is that one way that female lions go into estrus is when their cubs are killed. So if a new male takes over the pride, and as we've talked about on the podcast before, prides aren't really a patriarchy, although they're kind of seen that way in popular culture. It's like the core group of lions is typically females that have passed on from generation to generation. So you could look at it as a matriarchy in that way. I mean, it's true that the males do assert their dominance by killing all the cubs when they take over a pride, but it's like, it's kind of like, you know, they get this new lion leader, like not a leader though, because like the female lions kind of control the pride throughout the many, many years. The males come and go. It's the females that form the core of the pride. And so it's just like, they're so cool. These super metal lionesses, blood sisters synchronizing their periods.
Interesting deeper story. Like what if the Lion King was less about this, you know, exchange of power between the men, but these men who come and go, but one lioness loved one cub so much that she hid it from the new lion.
Ooh.
And now he's growing up with these cubs that are not his brothers.
I really like that idea. Yeah. That's awesome. I mean, that would be a much better movie. I mean, if they remade Lion King, why not just remake it? Do a new plot. Don't show us Uncanny Valley lions.
Yeah.
But I would love to see some biologically accurate animal movies because the reality is so much cooler. And like you said, you could have a much more interesting plot. Like that's almost like, what is it? That's almost like the Moses plot of like, you know, putting, it's like a Moses lion.
Yeah.
So instead of cribbing from Hamlet, like crib from Moses.
Yeah.
That'd be really cool. And so one method that they use to synchronize their estrus is potentially pheromone signals. They like smell each other and it's like, oh, you want to have babies? Sure, I'll join you.
Yeah.
Just like, want to go to brunch and have some babies?
Yeah, yeah. All right, it's baby time.
So here's another claim that I don't know. I've kind of not heard it before. I actually found this on Snopes. But I think I've heard things similar to it, which is that the human body replaces itself entirely every 7 years.
Oh.
Have you heard this one before?
Something close to it.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like I've heard similar stuff like, oh, you know, your body, like every cell in your body is replaced. And so you're like the ship of Theseus thing where it's like, oh, are you really you since we replace all of our cells mm-hmm. and such. But it's kind of a mixture of myth and fact. So cells do, it makes a lot of sense though why people would think that the entire body is replaced, because cells do die. It's a process called apoptosis, and then they regenerate through cell division. Some cells can kind of renew very rapidly, like skin cells. And the 7 years figure may have come from a study that found that the average age of a cell in the human body is around 7 to 10 years old, which is kind of like crazy to think about. Like, wait, I'm only 7 years
yeah.
old. I knew it was okay to like Power Rangers. A bunch of bronies feel very vindicated.
Yeah, yeah. We get off our backs.
But that's just an average. And, you know, average is not, it's not like most cells are like this. It's like you have some cells regenerating extremely quickly, like from days to weeks, like epithelial cells, which is like skin cells, lining of the stomach especially, that regenerates very quickly because of the acidity of the stomach. Organs, blood vessels also have epithelial cells that regenerate more quickly than other cells in the body. And then other cells like connective, muscle, and nervous cells last much longer. And bone also lasts quite long. Often, like, I think bone is replaced every 17 years-ish. The average age for non-epithelial cells are around 15 years old. But some cells last way longer. I mean, like your entire life. So certain cells we're born with and will die with, like the cells inside the center of our eye lens. We're actually born with that and we'll die with that.
Oh, wow.
And then our brain matter is a little younger than that lens mm-hmm. cells. Because we are developing our brains really rapidly when we're little, like until 2 years old. It's like you have this massive, and I mean, obviously the brain continues to develop after that, but we generated a bunch of this new tissue. But the brain tissue on average I think it's like they measured tissue inside the cerebellum and they found it was about as old as the individual. But there are certain parts of the gray matter that does regenerate more quickly. So basically some of our body does regenerate really quickly. Some of it regenerates more slowly. And then certain cells are going to be there basically for our entire lives. It makes sense to me that the brain, I think, is one of the more constant ones. It is still crazy that it isn't necessarily like you're not born with your entire brain and then you die with your that same brain, which is a little bit spooky.
Yeah.
But it isn't like your brain is completely new from like 7 years ago. It's, parts of it are going to be basically the same once your brain stops growing until you die.
And you stop developing brain cells at a certain age, right?
Right, yeah. Like, you're not going to grow a bunch of new brain cells. The main changes is the neuroplasticity, where it's not so much that you grow new cells, but your brain, that the cell, the neural pathways that form in your brain can change throughout your life. Obviously, they have to. Otherwise, you would never be able to form new memories or learn anything new. Your brain can change throughout your entire life. Obviously the greatest changes are from age 0 to like 25-ish, mm-hmm. but your brain continues to change throughout your life, but the cells themselves mostly stay the same once you've reached a certain age.
All right.
In some parts of the brain. Some parts of the brain regenerate more quickly. There is an animal that is basically like a Benjamin Buttons, where it can completely regenerate. And it is the immortal jellyfish.
Oh, really?
So these are teeny tiny cute jellyfish found in the Mediterranean and Sea of Japan. They're about like the size of a fingernail. They, along with a couple of other jellyfish species who are dumb and I'm not going to mention, I'm kidding. I think there's like the moon jelly. There's a moon jelly species that also does this, but they can revert back into a polyp, which is like the baby form of the jellyfish, and then become reborn. So this is called reverse metamorphosis.
Wow.
It's Benjamin Buttons.
Yeah.
Where they, turn back into a polyp, and then that polyp turns back into an adult. So biologists liken it to a chicken that turn into an egg, and then that egg hatches a new chicken. And to accomplish this, it goes through cellular transdifferentiation, which sounds like, you know, Full Metal Alchemist. You know that? Or wait, what's the anime? Is it Full Metal Alchemist a anime?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you got it.
I'm getting it confused with Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah. Which is a Stanley Kubrick film.
Yeah.
But yeah. No, Full Metal Alchemist, like they try and transmute different things. And
right.
That's how he gets his little brother trapped in that suit of armor.
Yeah, that's right. And like he gets a new hand, but it's made out of his dead mom. Is that right?
It's like metal. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I didn't get too deep into it, but I think so. It's very dark and bleak.
Right. But it sounds like something from that anime.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's where one cell type is converted into another cell type, like a skin cell becoming a neural cell. And humans, like basically only stem cells do this.
Yeah.
And we don't. It seems like they're so cool. The fact that they can turn into babies and then regrow into adults and do this potentially indefinitely until they're a snack for something else.
Yeah.
We don't actually know that much about them. Like, we haven't studied them that thoroughly because they're really hard to cultivate in a lab. In fact, from one article I read, there's only one scientist who's been able to reliably grow them in a lab. His name's Shin Kubota of Japan. And he's like in this tiny office and growing these miraculous jellyfish, and he's got very little funding, and he just does it because he thinks it's really important. That's so, there's something like really mysterious about this one man who knows how to grow these and is trying to study them, and basically is one of the few people who can nurture these. And he it's funny when he talks about them, like he's really proud of them, like, oh, these are my little babies.
My little guys.
Yeah.
My little immortal guys.
Yeah. You would think that an Elon Musk would be injecting them into his bloodstream to try to be
just to see. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What if we, what if that we have that ability, but with those parameters, like you can regenerate your body, but you'd have to go back to a baby.
It's almost like, to me, at what point is right? At what point is that just like when we have kids, you know?
Yeah.
Because wouldn't you be? I guess it depends on how much like of a, you know, biological essentialist you are, but I feel like we're not just what we're born with, we're all the experience we've had, you know, it's nature and nurture kind of working together to create you as a human. So I feel like at that point it wouldn't, even though maybe your body would be immortal, your mind wouldn't, like, you, once you revert back to a child or an embryo, that would be you dying essentially.
Yeah.
Even if you're reborn again, that would be a new person, in my opinion, just based on, I think, because we're a pretty special animal in terms of how much we can learn and how flexible our brains are. But I think that also means that we're kind of a sum of our experiences in our environment, and then that is who we are. And that's why, you know, when you have a brother or sister who's very close to you genetically, they can be super different.
Yeah.
And like, or, you know, a child who's, you know, maybe similar to you biologically, but they're, you know, going to be really different because they have different experiences.
Yeah. That's very interesting.
Yeah. Like I said before, sometimes the truth is actually wilder than myth. And what you might think of as myth collides with science. In the monasteries of eastern Tibet, Buddhist monks practice Jitamo meditation, a technique that is legendary for increasing the body's heat, even drying wet sheets wrapped around the monks' bodies as they meditate in the freezing Himalayas. But is there any truth to this? Researchers and monks well practiced in forceful breath Jitamo meditation put it to the test, the scientific test, and found that by meditating in this way, they were able to increase their body temperature, even up to mild fever levels. And more interestingly, it wasn't just the breathing that was important. The mental visualization of the Jitamo meditation technique was important in enabling the meditators to continue breathing properly and to keep their body temperature up. So, I want you to visualize this podcast returning after a short break. Breathe in and breathe out. We'll be right back. Welcome to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? That is the owner of a million spiders. I'm your host, Meowlix Trebark. So, Iffy, I want to play a little game.
All right, based off the title, I want to lose. I don't want these millions.
So I'm going to ask you some questions about animals and reveal some unexpected truths, perhaps.
Okay.
All right, and this is going to be about like what you think the characteristics of these animals are.
Okay.
So question number one is, who do you think has more eyes? Spiders, scallops, or scorpions? Is that helping, dude?
Like, yeah. Because I think spiders, but based on the premise of this game, I'm going to say scallops.
You are correct. So, spiders have 0 to 12 eyes. There are some spiders who are eyeless, like the blind huntsman spider of Laos and the blind cave wolf spider of Hawaii. Scorpions, similarly, have about 0 to 12 eyes. Same thing. Some of them don't have eyes. Some of them have 12 eyes. But scallops have up to 100 eyes.
Oh, wow.
So here, I want to show you this picture. It's pretty beautiful.
Oh, that is extremely terrifying.
I think it's kind of neat. So you see all those little blue dots?
Yeah.
Those are all of its eyeballs.
Oh, wow.
So they have from 10 to 100 eyes. The scallop is found all over the world in our oceans, on our plates, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But imagine this next time you're eating a scallop. They just have hundreds of eyeballs.
Oh, yeah.
They can actually swim around by opening and closing their valves. They're bivalves, meaning they got two valves.
Yeah.
They have these eyes, which tend to be a brilliant blue. They look like little blueberries, but hundreds of them, and they're all staring at you.
Oof, do you not like?
So their eyes are actually really interesting because they don't have lenses like most animals. Instead, they have a concave mirror made out of guanine, and if guanine sounds familiar, that's the same protein found in DNA. But guanine crystals can form this like shiny substance that it's actually found in like on skin of like chameleons and other things, but it can actually turn their eyes into these tiny telescopes. So these guanine crystals form a mirror, and that mirror focuses light inside of the eye. Like, you know, you've seen the giant mirror for the Hubble telescope,
yeah.
And you know how that helps redirect and focus the light. Works the same way for the scallop. And although their eyes can't make out distinct shapes, they can accurately sense changes in their environment, like changes in light and dark and a shadow passing over them, and even like different water conditions, so they know like how to evade predators or where to swim to find food or whether they need to avoid some poor water conditions. And we don't know much about the scallop brain, but like what's happening from the eyes to the brain, but
yeah.
I don't think they're very smart.
Okay.
So it is interesting that they're just lined with all of these kind of like sentry eyeballs.
Very weird looking.
Yeah. It looks very, I guess, like David Lynchian. He's like the alien guy,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. With all the like weird mouth tentacles and eyeballs and just think about that next when you get one of those nice Gordon Ramsay scallops on a plate.
You scoop all the eyes out.
Mm. Yep. Just like how I know like when I eat like crayfish, it's like their little tiny eyeballs staring at me like, why?
Why are you doing this?
No. It's really hard. All right. Next question. Which animal can grow a proper handlebar mustache? Horses, bonobos, or the Bornean bearded pig?
Horses?
Yes, you're correct. Wow, you're two for two.
I just saw a viral Twitter image of horses with mustaches. And
this one?
Yes. Oh, wow. Oh, so crazy.
Yes, so The Gypsy Vanner draft horse of Ireland can grow luxurious mustaches, and they really just look like a human mustache pasted on a horse, with no exaggeration. Usually that's because like the owner styles it a little bit. Yeah. Like if you leave it just to grow, it turns into this big mop.
Okay.
But the owner will like trim it and, curl it, and it just looks like a little, you know, one of those 1800s mustaches. All these guys named Bartholomew. And
oh, yeah. That's one dastardly horse. Has a pencil mustache.
Bonobos actually don't have mustaches.
Oh, really?
Although they are one of our closest primate relatives. The Bornean bearded pig actually grow reverse mustaches, so they grow a bunch of hair above their nose.
Oh, that's very weird.
Ugh. Yeah, they like grow this bristly hair that's like, imagine like the bridge of your nose. Imagine if you just grew a band of hair from the bridge of your nose all the way around your chin.
That's the worst goatee.
that's a worse than Guy Fieri though. Worse than that?
Definitely worse.
Imagine though, like with like mustard all over it. Still worse.
I mean, okay, then that's worse.
All right, last question, and this is actually inspired by someone. So I asked on Twitter for some questions from people, and this Madeline sent in a question. But first I'm going to ask you, which of these animals poop in cube shapes? Is it the naked mole rat, the wombat, or bees?
I'm gonna guess bees.
You are incorrect.
Oh no.
You almost got 100% though. So it is actually the wombat.
Ah.
And they are of Australia. And I'm
That's
showing...
dangerous. They look like little tiny mini brownies.
They do. Little wombat brownies. Yeah. Worse than accidentally eating weed brownies.
Yeah. You're like, oh no, this is a bad flavor.
Even worse if the wombat ate weed and you ate them. the question from Madeline is how is wombat poop cube shaped? Are there other animals with similar scat? And so as far as I know, this is the only animal that creates poop shaped cubes, or cube shaped poop.
Yeah.
Either way. And I did a little research on this. There's actually the conception, and here's another myth, that they poop in cubes so that the poop doesn't roll down hills so that they can mark their territory. I don't think there's actually evidence that this is true. Again, it hasn't been like proven false.
Yeah.
It's just, I read one biologist who studied wombats. He's like, they just poop wherever. They poop where they poop. The cube shape isn't necessarily for marking their territory. And recently, there's research by bodily fluids expert Patricia Yang and her colleagues at the Georgia Institute of Technology in the U.S.
What a job title.
I know. So they shipped in wombats from Australia, and these were actually roadkill wombats because it's hard to source wombats.
Yeah.
And so they shipped them in from Australia. They examined their intestines, and they found that the cube shape is probably due to, first of all, how dry the feces are. So wombats live in pretty dry environments. They have to preserve a lot of moisture, so they suck a lot of the water content out of the poop as it goes through their intestines. That allows it to maybe be shaped into that more brick-like shape. But one of the mechanism of forming it into cubes is they tested the elasticity of the intestines. And most intestines have a pretty uniform elasticity. But with wombats, they have these two ridges that are more elastic than the other parts of the intestine. So they almost form these like pockets where they like, I guess, kind of get like slide around and get squished into like a cube shape. Hands made out of intestines, like squishing them into cubes.
Here you go.
So they might be poop crucibles for making the square poop. There you go. That's why wombat is poop is cube shaped and how it happens.
Question I didn't know I needed an answer for.
Well, and now you do.
Yeah.
And now you can, all that sleep you've been missing, it's because deep down you needed this answer.
Exactly.
This question answered.
I no longer have to try and sleep with one eye.
Exactly. thank you so much for joining me. Do you want to talk a little bit about your podcast, Nerdificent?
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
Got anything to plug?
Oh, yeah. So Nerdificent, you know, it's with me and Danny Fernandez. We do nerdy deep dives into topics and have a guest on to talk about their experience with it. It's very casual, very fun. It's a, you know, it's a nerdy podcast for everyone, whether you've, you know, just got interested because you saw the new Captain Marvel, or if you've been a longtime person and you like to reminisce over, you know, the good old times. And also I do a podcast called Who Shot You? It's a movie podcast with Maximum Fun, where we, you know, it's just it's a movie podcast that isn't just white dudes.
Nice.
It's, but besides that, Ify Wadiway on Twitter and Instagram, Ifdies on Twitch if you like to watch people play video games, and you know, just come hang with me.
What's your favorite, like, animal themed superhero?
Ooh, Black Panther.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Because, you know, I had the bonus of being an African superhero. That's, so growing up as a Nigerian American, I was like, yeah.
Weirdly, comic books are kind of white males all
the
time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So not only, you know, not only that, we got Black Panther. He got him pretty early, too. He came out, like, a year after Spider-Man.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And he actually came out before the Black Panther party.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Black Panther, the superhero, existed before the party. So I like to imagine that Huey P. was at the comic book stand. He was like, huh, I got an idea.
Secretly a nerd.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's awesome. You mentioned where people can find you on Twitter.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome. You can find us creaturefeaturepod.com. On Instagram, Creature Feature Pod. On Twitter, Creature Feet Pod, F-E-A-T. Don't do F-E-E-T. And you can find me at Katie Golden. And I'm also at Pro Bird Rights, where I am definitely a human and not a bird.
Oh, I saw your account the other day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very funny. I think.
Yeah, thank you. It's pretty silly. It's got a lot of misspellings.
Yeah.
Which are totally on purpose. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you're liking the pod, you can help support us by leaving a comment or giving us a rating and subscribing and all that good stuff. Thank you so much. I'll see you next Wednesday.
Bye.
Bye. And thanks to the Space Cossacks for their awesome song, Exolumina.